Welcome. Welcome, friends, to ArtCast. Hey, I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, coming to you live this week from the Software Architects Summit at VS Live San Francisco, here in the beautiful Moscone Center. And in the city by the bay, it's raining. Just kind of reminds me of Seattle. But it's sunny inside and in my heart, where I'm thinking about you. I'm thinking about how we can help you learn and grow and develop as an architect. And today on the show, I am joined by Russ Nemhauser, who is one of the speakers here at VS Live, doing a great job telling the story about a topic that's near and dear to my heart, performance and scalability. So sit back, relax, learn something from Russ Nemhauser. Russ, you are one of the VS Live presenters who is here astounding the guests here at VS Live this week. What are you talking about here?
Oh, let's see. Yesterday I did a full-day workshop on how to implement high-performance ASP.NET applications, and tomorrow I'll do a session that's an introduction to AJAX using Atlas, which is Microsoft's technology to help make life easier for AJAX programmers. And then on Wednesday, I'll do a session for the VBITS track on messaging. So I'll show people how to use MSMQ to create message-based applications. So I'm looking forward to it. Those two sessions are new to me anyway.
All right. So when you're not here astounding people at VS Live, what do you do for a living?
Down in Los Angeles, I live with my wife and my pooch, Max. Give a shout out to Max. And I am an architect. I'm the quote, lead architect on a system that we're developing for the entertainment industry, a certain studio in the entertainment industry that will help them release their theatrical movies or acquisitions on home video.
So it's sort of an internal project, like something they would, not an external customer-facing project.
No, it's not an external project. It'll be internal to that studio. And my company also has projects at many other studios as well. So hopefully I'll be able to dabble in a bunch of other studios. And it's very energizing to go on the studio lots and, you know, walk around movie sets and television sets and stuff like that.
So, do you get to meet, like, famous people?
Well, yeah. In fact, last week I was able to, Alyssa Milano asked me out to lunch, and I said, sure.
Hey, there you go.
Just kidding, honey.
Well, you know, actually, I this was many years ago, went to Paramount Pictures, and I went through that gate that you see on TV and the studio guard, and I said, yes, I'm Ron Jacobs, and he looked on the list and said, right this way. Yep. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I didn't see anybody famous or anything. You know? So, but anyway, maybe you can get me a deal on some DVDs then.
I can certainly give it a try.
Oh, okay. All right. So, well, you know, I'll give you some deal on software then.
Yeah,
or something.
Okay. Cool.
No, of course not, because that would be unethical.
That would be. Yeah, is this thing on?
All right. So your talk about performance and scalability, I think, is real interesting because it happens to be based on the Patterns and Practices book, Improving .NET Application Performance and Scalability.
Yes, it is.
For which I was the product manager.
You were
book.
Not.
I was. Now, that doesn't mean I wrote any of it.
Right.
No, that was J.D. Meyer, the program manager on that, and his wonderful team. They did a bang-up job, but I was, you know, I had my hands in the pot anyway, you know. And certainly I went around the world kind of talking about it. And so it's been actually a fantastic resource.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I used to do this session with Doug Seven, who's the guy that helped me create it. He's up there in Seattle now working for Microsoft.
And, oh, he got assimilated too? Yeah.
He was assimilated, yeah.
And, resistance is futile, they say.
It is actually futile. One of the things I did at the presentation was I didn't think that we gave the book enough credit, because previously we'd only had a little note on the bottom of the first slide. This session is based on this book. So I took a snapshot image of the book cover and made that its own slide. So people knew very well that this is a book you can buy, a book you can download. It's very, very informative. And I even give the URL to the book as well. So I was very pleased with it.
Yeah, and actually, we did this trick where we got a very simple URL. If you go microsoft.com/scalenet, You go right to it.
Really? I wish I had known that before I gave my workshop yesterday.
Yeah, it's kind of a long, otherwise it's a long thing.
I'm telling people /ENUS/what.
You know, oh, yeah, that's terrible. Yeah, but it's a great resource. It's hasn't been updated for .NET 2.0 yet, but that work is on the plan.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so they're going to do that. And, of course, they did the security guide first.
Uh-huh.
And then they did perf and scale, and then we updated security guides, and now they're going to update perf and scale.
Beautiful.
Which is, but very, very necessary work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I learned so much from that book, and I felt that it was really something that people needed to know, and that's one of the reasons why Doug and I created this session, is it's knowledge that everyone, I think, if you're a developer, architect, tester, or administrator, I think everyone needs to be aware of so many of the concepts in this book. It certainly helped me.
You know, and the funny thing about it was that a lot of people think of a performance book as being something like, watch out for boxing and unboxing and, you know, little tweaks that, you know, here's 10 tweaks that you can do to make your code run a little bit faster, which I think is okay. I mean, those are kind of useful things. But those aren't the things, in my view, that really are going to make or break the performance and scalability of your system, are they?
I don't necessarily think that they are. I do talk about things like, you know, using iterators and enumerators and you know, looping versus recursion, because another stack frame gets put on the stack with recursion, where that isn't the case with looping. I do talk about boxing and value types versus reference types. And the truth is that that's a very small part of the talk. A lot of the talk has to do with making careful decisions about what you choose to use in your application. One simple example would be whether you choose to use a data set because you never know when you might need to page that data or sort it, or when you're a little bit more proactive about making good choices, and you might decide, you know what, this is data that I'm probably not going to want to sort or filter, so I'll go ahead and use a data reader. Something as simple as that. I think a lot of the talk is, I think, I know a lot of the talk is devoted to caching and caching in multiple places. When I started this new job of mine, I interviewed the four developers that were already there, and I was shocked to find out that not one of them knew what caching was. And so I've been able to help, you know, bring the caching way of thinking into the company. But there's lots and lots of things that have a lot more significant performance gains than just, you know, not boxing and unboxing your variables, or, you know, using for each instead of just, you know, using an integer and looping through things. You're absolutely right, I think.
Well, you know, in my view, though, the things that could have traumatic, terrible performance consequences are most likely the poor architecture decisions that people make, or even the silly ones. Like, you know, it's kind of funny. I remember back in the late 90s, I was working for an ISV here in Silicon Valley, and they had a product that was essentially two-tier kind of application. But they knew that Microsoft was coming out with MTS. This was 1997. And so they go, well, we have to use MTS. And we got to find out what it is and just plug it in there, you know?
Yeah.
We just have to use it. And, well, it was really a marketing-driven decision. They wanted to be able to say that they were using MTS. And so they sent me on a research project, and I went and worked up a way where we kind of shoved MTS in the middle of this architecture, but not in an intelligent way, but just in any old way, we could make it work.
Absolutely.
And when we measured the performance, it actually was worse than the previous solution, and they were really baffled by this. But, of course, it only made sense that now instead of going right from the client to the database, and we inserted a hop through another machine that slowed things down.
Yep.
But they didn't realize any value out of it. No scalability, nothing. We weren't even using the transactions or anything, which was completely brain dead. But this is a silly story just to point out, though, that oftentimes people get in the mindset like, oh, I have to use a three-tier architecture, and I have to, that means three physical machines, and blah blah blah. And you know, it's just dumb.
I couldn't agree more. I think that I have an example of that. A friend of mine who I used to work with went off to work with an insurance company, and he was all happy with himself because he had created this N-tier architecture where he had his database and his data access layer and his business logic layer and a web front end, and he was all happy. And I just asked him one day, you know, I'm just curious, you know, you said you were binding your open insurance quotes to the data form, to the web form there, you know, going through your business logic layer and returning a collection and stuff. How long, you know, how many requests per second are you getting out of that? And he didn't know anything about performance testing. And so by kind of circumventing the business logic layer and the data access layer and kind of having a web service whose sole purpose was to kind of have that data at the ready in a ready form, I was able to show him that you can get an order of magnitude difference in performance, which isn't to say don't use the object-oriented approach. It's to say, you know, yes, it exists, but it doesn't mean that it exists for every single circumstance. You still need to be, you need to know what's available to you as an architect in terms of tools, and we also need to know where it's proper to use those tools. Because something like an increase in an order of increase in magnitude of performance of an application as a whole can seriously directly translate to a lower total cost of ownership. You know, if your application can go from 10 to 100 users per second as a whole, chances are you're not going to need to spend as much on hardware.
Now, in your experience, though, in dealing with people building applications, do you find that most people have a clear sense of their performance targets, or are they just like shooting for, let's, you know, try to get as fast as possible and hope that's good enough?
I think that the bucket that I've fallen into often in the past is developers who want to get the job done and don't, believe it or not, don't even have performance in their head. I mean, you know, perceived performance, you know, I clicked the button and the Windows form did this quickly, or I clicked save on my web form and it came back within 2 seconds. You know, they keep that kind of performance in mind, but what they don't think about is, you know, true performance metrics. You know, time to last byte, number of requests per second. You know, how much memory is your application using as it ramps up on users? You know, how many user connections are you using on SQL Server? How many exceptions are being thrown in your application? Because that might have a negative impact on the performance overall. So there's lots of things that these developers don't even realize that I think they should be paying attention to. More so from the business unit, what happens a lot is that the business units will know they want something, but what they won't necessarily tell you is that we want it to happen this quickly. So if we're going to enter some new SKUs into our system, we want to have the web page come back in 1 second after each SKU. And that's really important to us because we're flying through these things. They just say we need to be able to enter SKUs. And here's a name and here's a number of a SKU. You know, go ahead and build that. So I think it really needs to start from the business standpoint. They need to tell the developers and tell the architect, you know, how well they need these things to perform.
Well, in fact, that's a very important question, I think, that the architect needs to ask. Because you're right, a business user just says, oh, well, you know, we need to enter some SKUs. And then, you know, in their mind, they have a picture or an expectation about what they think that's going to be.
Right.
And then when you come and deliver the thing and it takes 5 seconds to save it, they go, well, that's never going to work, you know, and then,
right.
Then you got a big problem because you're trying to fix it after the fact.
But, right.
But like those developers you were saying, you know, and I've been there, right, you just want to get the thing working,
right?
Oh, yeah, I saved and no errors happened. But, you know, and you're thinking, well, the performance is acceptable, sure, with one concurrent user and, you know, 10 rows in the database.
Right.
Yeah, it works great.
Yep, absolutely. Once you get 10,000 rows in there and 100 users, that's a whole different story. And that's really something that only stress testing, I think, can get you to unless you have the budget to hire 100 people to come in and use the system as the real business users would. Stress testing is a way to find out what your app is really capable of without having to wait X number of hours, days, or months, or even years to find out, you know, what can it do? Under what load? How many users does it take to bring my application down? When can I no longer support the expected workload? Stress testing can tell you that a lot quicker than reality can.
Well, and the good point is that, you know, a lot of architects think this is a developer problem. You know, and so they go, well, I'm going to tell you what you have to build, and it's up to you guys to make it fast enough.
Right.
But I think a smart, a wise architect – would be thinking about how do we know for sure this system can deliver on, I think there's three dimensions of performance. There's like the overall throughput, which is like the request per second of the system as a whole. There's the dimension of concurrent users.
Right.
And then there's the sort of perceived performance of response time,
right,
which is, gets to like the time to last byte and that sort of thing. So if you have to have a clear sense of all three of these dimensions, otherwise you're not going to have a target that you can really measure against.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I say in the workshop, I think it's about halfway through, I kind of ask the question of the audience, you know, how many have done the old create an animated GIF to put on the web form to make people think something's happening. And, you know, people laugh and they raise their hands. And you know what? The truth is that a lot of times that works. They see this animated GIF that really, in reality, means less than nothing. But yet the people who are using the system actually believe, wow, okay, it's this far along. And even when that little bar graph fills up and then goes back to zero and starts again, they're like, wow, this thing's really chugging along, and they think it's working.
It must be doing something
exactly,
important.
Exactly,
exactly. Well, you know, the other important aspect of getting the performance targets clear is that we need to get beyond notions of has to be as fast as possible,
right,
to it has to be fast enough. Because there's a lot of difference in cost, in time, in hardware to get from, you know, one level of performance to the next level.
Right. I think that that's a very true statement. I think that there is a big difference between going from 100 requests per second to 300 requests per second. But do you really need to spend all the time necessary to go from 300 requests per second to 310? I mean, you're probably really not going to notice much of a performance difference there. And there, I've known developers who will sit there, and this is, of course, when I was not in charge, but they'll sit there, and they have full-time jobs, right? They'll sit there, and they will go over the code, and they will try to tweak and get every last millisecond out of every single line, and you just want to say to them, stop. I mean, you know, the ideal case is not to be the fastest possible code ever written in the history of mankind for your particular module. It's for it to be accepted by the business unit, for it to perform well, but not to have every last little bit of performance tweaked out of it and have it take you 3 months to get it there when you could have had it ready 3 months ago.
Yeah, that's what my back when I was a developer, my manager used to accuse me of writing gold-plated code.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I thought, well, hey, that's cool. You know, it's great that my code is gold-plated. It's the gold standard of code, you know.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if I needed to be done with it 2 weeks ago and I'm still tweaking it, that's a bad thing.
It is. And it all always seems to boil down to two things. It all boils down to time and money. And that's what businesses are interested in. How long will it take you to build it, and how much will it cost? And once you tell them and you do go through negotiations, they're not happy when it takes longer or costs more. So you do have to draw that line.
I was always like the temperamental artist. So if you ask me, well, how long will that take you? I'd say, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm going to work on it till it's done.
You know what always used to bother me? And this happened at Universal constantly. Ugh. It always used to bother me when the business owners would create this great new feature for the online store, such as they want to be able to handle coupons and promotions and stuff like that. And they'd say, so what we need you to do is get this implemented by the 15th. And it's like, well, you know, it would have been nice if you had actually come to me and involved me in the conversation where you come up with a date the 15th, because you realize today's the 9th, you know? And I never appreciated it when the business would dictate to me how long things would take. And luckily, that doesn't happen a lot anymore. You know, I'm able to say, okay, give me your requirements and I'll let you know how long it'll take to build, which is a much better way, I think, to work as an architect.
Well, and in fact, having a real clear idea of performance targets, having everybody on the same page, the business stakeholders, the developers, the architects, we all know what we're shooting for. If we've done that, then we can have a reasonable conversation when it comes to optimization. So when we get to should we cache or should we not cache, The first question you're asking is, are we hitting the performance target?
Right.
If we are, then done.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't need to.
Chances are you could gain much more performance by implementing that cache, but that also takes time, which costs money. So if you're done, you're done.
Yeah. And you know, you can always make you can make little notes like for the future and say, Well, you know, in the future, if we decide this thing is slowed down, we could put a cache here and, You know, put your little comment in the code to do.
I was just going to say the same exact thing. That little to do thing is wonderful.
Yeah, because you'll know that you can come back to that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's so key. Well, and the other thing is it reminds me of when I was working here in Silicon Valley, I was writing a resource editor tool that would allow you to take these executables that you had written in this proprietary language I used to work on.
Really?
And you could...
Ron.net?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, and you could give your executable to a translator who would localize it into different languages. And so we were working on this tool, and it worked reasonably well. We'd take a little app, and you know, we'd test little test apps, and we would do stuff with them, and it was fine. And then one day our boss came in and said, we found the largest executable that any of our customers has ever built, and we want you to test that tool with it. And so he gave me a 20 megabyte executable file.
Wow. And how many years ago was this?
This was, in 96, maybe.
Wow, okay.
95, 96. So that was massive back then.
I mean,
it was, you know, it would probably way consume all the memory that anybody would ever have, you know. And we go and load up that file and went to lunch, and we came back, and it's still loading, it's still loading, and finally, you know, a couple hours later, it finished loading.
Wow.
And then, but the thing was, I realized that the way we had architected, the fundamental assumptions of the architecture completely broke down when you had that many things.
Right.
I mean, in just a simple way, is all of the resources that you could edit were in a tree view.
Right.
Right. Well, the tree view is great when you got a few dozen or 100 or something, but when you get like 20,000 items, tree views are a total pain in the neck.
Absolutely.
You know, but see, that was a failure of our architecture because we hadn't considered I guess that really makes a fourth dimension of performance. So we had request per second, throughput, we had concurrent users, we had response time, and a fourth dimension would be like the volume of data that you have to push through the system, because that matters a lot, especially like in the media business like you are. If you're pushing around lots of big MPEGs and stuff, I mean, that's going to matter a lot.
Well, I think that's true, and to be honest with you, I thought the fourth one you were going to mention there was future requirements, because, you know, you say that your architecture was incorrect. I mean, the truth is, if you didn't think you were going to have 20 megabyte executables, you know, and you were going to be capped out at 5 for the foreseeable future, chances are your architecture wasn't incorrect. So I think that, you know, having an accurate assessment of what really holds true in the future, at least as accurate as possible, is a good thing. There was this commercial on years ago where this company had an offer, and they were going to run this commercial, and they ran the commercial, and the next day they come in and they're watching the orders tick in, and sure enough, they get so many orders the servers all crash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times you can't predict the future, but you really can. I think a lot of times come pretty close, and I think it's important to sit down and think of where this thing could go, you know, 1, 3, 5 years down the road. A lot of times the 5-year target can be pretty hard to hit. But I think it's useful to at least, you know, think about it and keep it in mind.
Yeah, well, and if you have these targets in place, then it also helps you to, as you're evaluating design decisions and trade-offs about things like, well, you know, should we put this object on the same server as the web server, or should we put it on an application server sitting over there?
Right.
Which has an enormous impact.
Right.
The amount of time to call that object now is going to be about 10,000 times greater than what it was before.
Right. Absolutely.
But people are often making that kind of decision with no clue about their performance impact.
But you know what? It's N tier. That's really all that matters, right? It's N tier. Scalable. I think there's a lot of things that we all have to keep in mind, and it's not always easy. How do you measure performance and scalability when, you know, as compared to manageability and security and things of this nature? You know, it's not an easy task.
Well, in fact, when I was building products at Microsoft, one of the things we did was, you know, when we were writing our specification for functionality of the product, we would give these targets, and then the test team would immediately, from very, very early on, would develop performance tests. So the very first build we had that one might possibly even work, they would run performance tests on it.
Right.
And then each day's builds, I would get, like, we'd have an Excel sheet that would show the trend over time of performance numbers. So I could see, like, how this build compared to the previous 10.
Right.
And whether we're getting worse or better, moving towards or away from the goal.
Absolutely. I think that kind of analysis is very useful to architects and developers. When I was developing, I would performance test my own code, which is something very few developers did. And I loved finding out whether a change I made it better or worse.
Well, hey, Russ, I appreciate you taking the time to stop by today.
It's been great. I'm so glad you asked. Glad I was able to participate.
Russ Nemhauser, ladies and gentlemen, performance and scalability guy, amazing the crowds here at VS Live. Gotta love that. I love the whole conference thing, you know, where you get in here and you learn a bunch of stuff. And VS Live is a terrific event. Happens in a lot of places. I've done VS Lives in Orlando and Toronto, and they had it in Las Vegas and Boston and New York. And I was in VS Live Sydney recently down in Australia. So, and I get to meet a lot of people who listen to ArtCast. And thank you for listening. Thanks for sending your notes, because I really enjoy reading those, and send away to ron.jacobs@microsoft.com. Looking forward to the next ArtCast.